Summer. I. A girl came out of Lawyer Royal's house, at the end of the one street of North Dormer, and stood on the doorstep. It was the beginning of a June afternoon. The spring-like transparent sky shed a rain of silver sunshine on the roofs of the village, and on the pastures and larch woods surrounding it. A little wind moved among the round white clouds on the shoulders of the hills, driving their shadows across the fields and down the grassy road that takes the name of street when it passes through North Dormer. The place lies high and in the open, and lacks the lavish shade of the more protected New England villages. The clump of weeping willows about the duck pond, and the Norway spruces in front of the Hatchard Gate, cast almost the only roadside shadow between Lawyer Royal's house and the point where, at the other end of the village, the road rises above the church and skirts the black hemlock wall enclosing the cemetery. The little June wind, frisking down the street, shook the doleful fringes of the Hatchard spruces, caught the straw hat of a young man just passing under them, and spun it clean across the road into the duck pond. As he ran to fish it out, the girl on Lawyer Royal's doorstep noticed that he was a stranger, that he wore city clothes, and that he was laughing with all his teeth, as the young and careless laugh at such mishaps. Her heart contracted a little, and the shrinking that sometimes came over her when she saw people with holiday faces made her draw back into the house and pretend to look for the key that she knew she had already put into her pocket. A narrow greenish mirror with a gilt eagle over it hung on the passage wall, and she looked critically at her reflection, wished for the thousandth time that she had blue eyes like Annabelle Balk, the girl who sometimes came from Springfield to spend a week with old Miss Hatchard, straightened the sunburned hat over her small swarthy face, and turned out again into the sunshine. "How I hate everything," she murmured. The young man had passed through the Hatchard Gate, and she had the street to herself. North Dormer is at all times an empty place, and at 3 o'clock on a June afternoon its few able-bodied men are off in the fields or woods, and the women indoors, engaged in languid household drudgery. The girl walked along, swinging her key on a finger, and looking about her with the heightened attention produced by the presence of a stranger in a familiar place. What, she wondered, did North Dormer look like to people from other parts of the world? She herself had lived there since the age of 5, and had long supposed it to be a place of some importance. But about a year before, Mr. Miles, the new Episcopal clergyman at Hepburn, who drove over every other Sunday when the roads were not plowed up by hauling to hold a service in the North Dormer Church, had proposed, in a fit of missionary zeal, to take the young people down to Nettleton to hear an illustrated lecture on the Holy Land, and the dozen girls and boys who represented the future of North Dormer had been piled into a farm wagon, driven over the hills to Hepburn, put into a way train and carried to Nettleton. In the course of that incredible day, Charity Royal had, for the first and only time, experienced railway travel, looked into shops with plate glass fronts, tasted coconut pie, sat in a theater, and listened to a gentleman saying unintelligible things before pictures that she would have enjoyed looking at if his explanations had not prevented her from understanding them. This initiation had shown her that North Dormer was a small place, and developed in her a thirst for information that her position as custodian of the village library had previously failed to excite. For a month or two she dipped feverishly and disconnectedly into the dusty volumes of the Hatchard Memorial Library, then the impression of Nettleton began to fade, and she found it easier to take North Dormer as the norm of the universe than to go on reading. The sight of the stranger once more revived memories of Nettleton, and North Dormer shrank to its real size. As she looked up and down it, from Lawyer Royal's faded red house at one end to the white church at the other, she pitilessly took its measure. There it lay, a weather-beaten sunburnt village of the hills, abandoned of men, left apart by railway, trolley, telegraph, and all the forces that link life to life in modern communities. I had no shops, no theaters, no lectures, no business block, only a church that was opened every other Sunday if the state of the roads permitted, and a library for which no new books had been bought for 20 years, and where the old ones moldered undisturbed on the damp shelves. Yet Charity Royal had always been told that she ought to consider it a privilege that her lot had been cast in North Dormer. She knew that, compared to the place she had come from, North Dormer represented all the blessings of the most refined civilization. Everyone in the village had told her so ever since she had been brought there as a child. Even old Miss Hatchard had said to her, on a terrible occasion in her life, "My child, you must never cease to remember that it was Mr. Royal who brought you down from the mountain." She had been brought down from the mountain, from the scarred cliff that lifted its sullen wall above the lesser slopes of Eagle Range, making a perpetual background of gloom to the lonely valley. The mountain was a good 15 miles away, but it rose so abruptly from the lower hills that it seemed almost to cast its shadow over North Dormer. And it was like a great magnet drawing the clouds and scattering them in storm across the valley. If ever, in the purest summer sky, there trailed a thread of vapor over North Dormer, it drifted to the mountain as a ship drifts to a whirlpool, and was caught among the rocks, torn up and multiplied, to sweep back over the village in rain and darkness. Charity was not very clear about the mountain, but she knew it was a bad place, and ashamed to have come from, and that, whatever befell her in North Dormer, she ought, as Miss Hatchard had once reminded her, to remember that she had been brought down from there, and hold her tongue and be thankful. She looked up at the mountain, thinking of these things, and tried as usual to be thankful. But the sight of the young man turning in at Miss Hatchard's gate had brought back the vision of the glittering streets of Nettleton, and she felt ashamed of her old sun hat, and sick of North Dormer, and jealously aware of Annabel Balk of Springfield, opening her blue eyes somewhere far off on glories greater than the glories of Nettleton. "How I hate everything," she said again. Halfway down the street she stopped at a weak-hinged gate. Passing through it, she walked down a brick path to a queer little brick temple with white wooden columns supporting a pediment on which was inscribed in tarnished gold letters, "The Honorius Hatchard Memorial Library, 1832. Honorius Hatchard had been old Miss Hatchard's great uncle, though she would undoubtedly have reversed the phrase, and put forward, as her only claim to distinction, the fact that she was his great niece. For Honorius Hatchard, in the early years of the 19th century, had enjoyed a modest celebrity. As the marble tablet in the interior of the library informed its infrequent visitors, he had possessed marked literary gifts, written a series of papers called The Recluse of Eagle Range, enjoyed the acquaintance of Washington Irving and Fitz Greene Halleck, and been cut off in his flower by a fever contracted in Italy. Such had been the sole link between North Dormer and literature, a link piously commemorated by the erection of the monument where Charity Royal, every Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, sat at her desk under a freckled steel engraving of the deceased author, and wondered if he felt any deader in his grave than she did in his library. Entering her prison house with a listless step, she took off her hat, hung it on a plaster bust of Minerva, opened the shutters, leaned out to see if there were any eggs in the swallow's nest above one of the windows, and finally, seating herself behind the desk, drew out a roll of cotton lace and a steel crochet hook. She was not an expert workwoman, and it had taken her many weeks to make the half yard of narrow lace which she kept wound about the buckram back of a disintegrated copy of The Lamplighter. But there was no other way of getting any lace to trim her summer blouse, and since Ally Haas, the poorest girl in the village, had shown herself in church with enviable transparencies about the shoulders, Charity's hook had traveled faster. She unrolled the lace, dug the hook into a loop, and bent to the task with furrowed brows. Suddenly the door opened, and before she had raised her eyes she knew that the young man she had seen going in at the Hatchard gate had entered the library. Without taking any notice of her he began to move slowly about the long vault-like room, his hands behind his back, his short-sighted eyes peering up and down the rows of rusty bindings. At length he reached the desk and stood before her. "Have you a card catalogue?" he asked in a pleasant abrupt voice, and the oddness of the question caused her to drop her work.
"A what?"
"Why, you know," he broke off, and she became conscious that he was looking at her for the first time, having apparently, on his entrance, included her in his general short-sighted survey as part of the furniture of the library. The fact that, in discovering her, he lost the thread of his remark, did not escape her attention, and she looked down and smiled. He smiled also. "No, I don't suppose you do know," he corrected himself. "In fact, it would be almost a pity." She thought she detected a slight condescension in his tone, and asked sharply, "Why?" "Because it's so much pleasanter, in a small library like this, to poke about by oneself with the help of the librarian." He added the last phrase so respectfully that she was mollified, and rejoined with a sigh, "I'm afraid I can't help you much." "Why?" he questioned in his turn, and she replied that there weren't many books anyhow, and that she'd hardly read any of them. "The worms are getting at them," she added gloomily.
"Are they?
That's a pity, for I see there are some good ones." He seemed to have lost interest in their conversation, and strolled away again, apparently forgetting her. His indifference nettled her, and she picked up her work, resolved not to offer him the least assistance. Apparently he did not need it, for he spent a long time with his back to her, lifting down, one after another, the tall cobwebby volumes from a distant shelf.
"Oh, I say,"
he exclaimed, and looking up she saw that he had drawn out his handkerchief and was carefully wiping the edges of the book in his hand. The action struck her as an unwarranted criticism on her care of the books, and she said irritably, "It's not my fault if they're dirty."
He turned around and looked at her with reviving interest.
Ah, then you're not the librarian?
Of course I am, but I can't dust all these books. Besides, nobody ever looks at them, now Miss Hatchard's too lame to come round.
No, I suppose not. He laid down the book he had been wiping, and stood considering her in silence. She wondered if Miss Hatchard had sent him round to pry into the way the library was looked after, and the suspicion increased her resentment.
I saw you going into her house just now, didn't I?
She asked, with a New England avoidance of the proper name. She was determined to find out why he was poking about among her books.
Miss Hatchard's house?
Yes, she's my cousin and I'm staying there, the young man answered, adding, as if to disarm a visible distrust, my name is Harney, Lucius Harney. She may have spoken of me.
No, she hasn't, said Charity, wishing she could have said, yes, she has.
Oh, well, said Miss Hatchard's cousin with a laugh, and after another pause, during which it occurred to Charity that her answer had not been encouraging, he remarked, you don't seem strong on architecture. Her bewilderment was complete. The more she wished to appear to understand him, the more unintelligible his remarks became. He reminded her of the gentleman who had explained the pictures at Nettleton, and the weight of her ignorance settled down on her again like a pall.
I mean, I can't see that you have any books on the old houses about here. I suppose, for that matter, this part of the country hasn't been much explored. They all go on doing Plymouth and Salem. So stupid. My cousin's house, now, is remarkable. This place must have had a past, it must have been more of a place once.
He stopped short, with the blush of a shy man who overhears himself, and fears he has been voluble. I'm an architect, you see, and I'm hunting up old houses in these parts.
She stared. Old houses? Everything's old in North Dormer, isn't it?
The folks are, anyhow.
He laughed, and wandered away again.
Haven't you any kind of a history of the place? I think there was one written about 1840, a book or pamphlet about its first settlement, he presently said from the farther end of the room. She pressed her crochet hook against her lip and pondered. There was such a work, she knew, North Dormer and the early townships of Eagle County. She had a special grudge against it because it was a limp weekly book that was always either falling off the shelf or slipping back and disappearing if one squeezed it in between sustaining volumes. She remembered, the last time she had picked it up, wondering how anyone could have taken the trouble to write a book about North Dormer and its neighbors, Dormer, Hamblin, Creston, and Creston River. She knew them all, mere lost clusters of houses in the folds of the desolate ridges, Dormer, where North Dormer went for its apples, Creston River, where there used to be a paper mill, and its gray walls stood decaying by the stream, and Hamblin, where the first snow always fell. Such were their titles to fame. She got up and began to move about vaguely before the shelves. But she had no idea where she had last put the book, and something told her that it was going to play her its usual trick and remain invisible. It was not one of her lucky days. I guess it's somewhere, she said, to prove her zeal, but she spoke without conviction, and felt that her words conveyed none. Oh, well, he said again. She knew he was going, and wished more than ever to find the book. It will be for next time, he added, and picking up the volume he had laid on the desk he handed it to her. By the way, a little air and sun would do this good, it's rather valuable. He gave her a nod and smile, and passed out too. The hours of the Hatchard Memorial Librarian were from 3 to 5, and Charity Royal's sense of duty usually kept her at her desk until nearly 4:30. But she had never perceived that any practical advantage thereby accrued either to North Dormer or to herself, and she had no scruple in decreeing, when it suited her, that the library should close an hour earlier. A few minutes after Mr. Harney's departure she formed this decision, put away her lace, fastened the shutters, and turned the key in the door of the Temple of Knowledge. The street upon which she emerged was still empty, and after glancing up and down it she began to walk toward her house. But instead of entering she passed on, turned into a field path and mounted to a pasture on the hillside. She let down the bars of the gate, followed a trail along the crumbling wall of the pasture, and walked until she reached a knoll where a clump of larches shook out their fresh tassels to the wind. There she lay down on the slope, tossed off her hat and hid her face in the grass. She was blind and insensible to many things, and dimly knew it, but to all that was light and air, perfume and color, every drop of blood in her responded. She loved the roughness of the dry mountain grass under her palms, the smell of the thyme into which she crushed her face, the fingering of the wind in her hair and through her cotton blouse, and the creak of the larches as they swayed to it.
She often climbed up the hill and lay there alone for the mere pleasure of feeling the wind and of rubbing her cheeks in the grass. Generally at such times she did not think of anything, but lay immersed in an inarticulate well-being. Today the sense of well-being was intensified by her joy at escaping from the library. She liked well enough to have a friend drop in and talk to her when she was on duty, but she hated to be bothered about books. How could she remember where they were, when they were so seldom asked for? Orma Fry occasionally took out a novel, and her brother Ben was fond of what he called geography, and of books relating to trade and bookkeeping, but no one else asked for anything except, at intervals, Uncle Tom's Cabin, or Opening of a Chestnut Burr, or Longfellow. She had these under her hand, and could have found them in the dark, but unexpected demands came so rarely that they exasperated her like an injustice. She had liked the young man's looks, and his short-sighted eyes, and his odd way of speaking, that was abrupt yet soft, just as his hands were sunburnt and sinewy, yet with smooth nails like a woman's. His hair was sunburnt-looking too, or rather the color of bracken after frost, his eyes gray, with the appealing look of the short-sighted, his smile shy yet confident, as if he knew lots of things she had never dreamed of, and yet wouldn't for the world have had her feel his superiority. But she did feel it, and liked the feeling, for it was new to her. Poor and ignorant as she was, and knew herself to be humblest of the humble even in North Dormer, where to come from the mountain was the worst disgrace yet in her narrow world she had always ruled. It was partly, of course, owing to the fact that Lawyer Royal was the biggest man in North Dormer, so much too big for it, in fact, that outsiders, who didn't know, always wondered how it held him. In spite of everything and in spite even of Miss Hatchard, Lawyer Royal ruled in North Dormer, and Charity ruled in Lawyer Royal's house. She had never put it to herself in those terms, but she knew her power, knew what it was made of, and hated it. Confusedly, the young man in the library had made her feel for the first time what might be the sweetness of dependence. She sat up, brushed the bits of grass from her hair, and looked down on the house where she held sway. It stood just below her, cheerless and untended, its faded red front divided from the road by a yard with a path bordered by gooseberry bushes, a stone well overgrown with traveler's joy, and a sickly crimson rambler tied to a fan-shaped support, which Mr. Royal had once brought up from Hepburn to please her. Behind the house a bit of uneven ground with clotheslines strung across it stretched up to a dry wall, and beyond the wall a patch of corn and a few rows of potatoes strayed vaguely into the adjoining wilderness of rock and fern. Charity could not recall her first sight of the house. She had been told that she was ill of a fever when she was brought down from the mountain, and she could only remember waking one day in a cot at the foot of Mrs. Royal's bed, and opening her eyes on the cold neatness of the room that was afterward to be hers. Mrs. Royal died 7 or 8 years later, and by that time Charity had taken the measure of most things about her. She knew that Mrs. Royal was sad and timid and weak, she knew that Lawyer Royal was harsh and violent, and still weaker. She knew that she had been christened Charity, in the white church at the other end of the village, to commemorate Mr. Royal's disinterestedness in bringing her down, and to keep alive in her a becoming sense of her dependence. She knew that Mr. Royal was her guardian, but that he had not legally adopted her, though everybody spoke of her as Charity Royal, and she knew why he had come back to life at North Dormer, instead of practicing at Nettleton, where he had begun his legal career. After Mrs. Royal's death there was some talk of sending her to a boarding school. Miss Hatchard suggested it, and had a long conference with Mr. Royal, who, in pursuance of her plan, departed one day for Starkfield to visit the institution she recommended. He came back the next night with a black face, worse, Charity observed, than she had ever seen him, and by that time she had had some experience. When she asked him how soon she was to start he answered shortly, "You ain't going," and shut himself up in the room he called his office, and the next day the lady who kept the school at Starkfield wrote that under the circumstances she was afraid she could not make room just then for another pupil. Charity was disappointed, but she understood. It wasn't the temptations of Starkfield that had been Mr. Royal's undoing, it was the thought of losing her. He was a dreadfully lonesome man, she had made that out because she was so lonesome herself. He and she, face to face in that sad house, had sounded the depths of isolation, and though she felt no particular affection for him, and not the slightest gratitude, she pitied him because she was conscious that he was superior to the people about him, and that she was the only being between him and solitude. Therefore, when Miss Hatchard sent for her a day or two later, to talk of a school at Nettleton, and to say that this time a friend of hers would make the necessary arrangements, Charity cut her short with the announcement that she had decided not to leave North Dormer. Miss Hatchard reasoned with her kindly, but to no purpose, she simply repeated, "I guess Mr. Royal's too lonesome." Miss Hatchard blinked perplexedly behind her eyeglasses. Her long frail face was full of puzzled wrinkles, and she leant forward, resting her hands on the arms of her mahogany armchair, with the evident desire to say something that ought to be said. "The feeling does you credit, my dear." She looked about the pale walls of her sitting room, seeking counsel of ancestral daguerreotypes and didactic samplers, but they seemed to make utterance more difficult. "The fact is, it's not only because of the advantages. There are other reasons. You're too young to understand."
"Oh, no, I ain't," said Charity harshly, and Miss Hatchard blushed to the roots of her blonde cap. But she must have felt a vague relief at having her explanation cut short, for she concluded, again invoking the daguerreotypes, "Of course I shall always do what I can for you, and in case, you know you can always come to me."
Lawyer Royal was waiting for Charity in the porch when she returned from this visit. He had shaved, and brushed his black coat, and looked a magnificent monument of a man. At such moments she really admired him.
"Well," he said, "is it settled?"
"Yes, it's settled. I ain't going."
"Not to the Nettleton school?"
"Not anywhere."
He cleared his throat and asked sternly, "Why?"
"I'd rather not," she said, swinging past him on her way to her room. It was the following week that he brought her up the Crimson Rambler in its Fan from Hepburn. He had never given her anything before. The next outstanding incident of her life had happened 2 years later, when she was 17. Lawyer Royal, who hated to go to Nettleton, had been called there in connection with a case. He still exercised his profession, though litigation languished in North Dormer and its outlying hamlets, and for once he had had an opportunity that he could not afford to refuse. He spent 3 days in Nettleton, won his case, and came back in high good humor. It was a rare mood with him, and manifested itself on this occasion by his talking impressively at the supper table of the rousing welcome his old friends had given him. He wound up confidentially, "I was a damn fool ever to leave Nettleton. It was Mrs. Royal that made me do it." Charity immediately perceived that something bitter had happened to him, and that he was trying to talk down the recollection. She went up to bed early, leaving him seated in moody thought, his elbows propped on the worn oilcloth of the supper table. On the way up she had extracted from his overcoat pocket the key of the cupboard where the bottle of whiskey was kept. She was awakened by a rattling at her door and jumped out of bed. She heard Mr. Royal's voice, low and peremptory, and opened the door, fearing an accident. No other thought had occurred to her, but when she saw him in the doorway, a ray from the autumn moon falling on his discomposed face, she understood. For a moment they looked at each other in silence, then, as he put his foot across the threshold, she stretched out her arm and stopped him. "You go right back from here," she said, in a shrill voice that startled her, "you ain't going to have that key tonight."
"Charity, let me in. I don't want the key. I'm a lonesome man," he began, in the deep voice that sometimes moved her.
Her heart gave a startled plunge, but she continued to hold him back contemptuously.
"Well, I guess you made a mistake, then. This ain't your wife's room any longer."
She was not frightened, she simply felt a deep disgust, and perhaps he divined it or read it in her face, for after staring at her a moment he drew back and turned slowly away from the door. With her ear to her keyhole she heard him feel his way down the dark stairs, and toward the kitchen, and she listened for the crash of the cupboard panel, but instead she heard him, after an interval, unlock the door of the house, and his heavy steps came to her through the silence as he walked down the path. She crept to the window and saw his bent figure striding up the road in the moonlight. Then a belated sense of fear came to her with the consciousness of victory, and she slipped into bed, cold to the bone. A day or two later poor Eudora Skeff, who for 20 years had been the custodian of the Hatchard Library, died suddenly of pneumonia, and the day after the funeral Charity went to see Miss Hatchard, and asked to be appointed librarian. The request seemed to surprise Miss Hatchard, she evidently questioned the new candidate's qualifications.
"Why, I don't know, my dear. Aren't you rather too young?" she hesitated.
"I want to earn some money," Charity merely answered.
"Doesn't Mr. Royal give you all you require? No one is rich in North Dormer."
"I want to earn money enough to get away."
"To get away?"
Miss Hatchard's puzzled wrinkles deepened, and there was a distressful pause. "You want to leave Mr. Royal?"
"Yes, or I want another woman in the house with me," said Charity resolutely.
Miss Hatchard clasped her nervous hands about the arms of her chair. Her eyes invoked the faded countenances on the wall, and after a faint cough of indecision she brought out, The house works too hard for you, I suppose?" Charity's heart grew cold. She understood that Miss Hatchard had no help to give her and that she would have to fight her way out of her difficulty alone. A deeper sense of isolation overcame her. She felt incalculably old. She's got to be talked to like a baby, she thought, with a feeling of compassion for Miss Hatchard's long immaturity. Yes, that's it, she said aloud. The house works too hard for me, I've been coughing a good deal this fall. She noted the immediate effect of this suggestion. Miss Hatchard paled at the memory of poor Eudora's taking off, and promised to do what she could. But of course there were people she must consult, the clergyman, the selectmen of North Dormer, and a distant Hatchard relative at Springfield. If you'd only gone to school. She sighed. She followed Charity to the door, and there, in the security of the threshold, said with a glance of evasive appeal, I know Mr. Royal is trying at times, but his wife bore with him, and you must always remember, Charity, that it was Mr. Royal who brought you down from the mountain. Charity went home and opened the door of Mr. Royal's office. He was sitting there by the stove reading Daniel Webster's speeches. They had met at meals during the 5 days that had elapsed since he had come to her door, and she had walked at his side at Eudora's funeral, but they had not spoken a word to each other. He glanced up in surprise as she entered, and she noticed that he was unshaved, and that he looked unusually old, but as she had always thought of him as an old man, the change in his appearance did not move her. She told him she had been to see Miss Hatchard, and with what object. She saw that he was astonished, but he made no comment. I told her the housework was too hard for me, and I wanted to earn the money to pay for a hired girl. But I ain't going to pay for her, you've got to. I want to have some money of my own. Mr. Royal's bushy black eyebrows were drawn together in a frown, and he sat drumming with ink-stained nails on the edge of his desk. What do you want to earn money for? He asked. So's to get away when I want to. Why do you want to get away? Her contempt flashed out. Do you suppose anybody'd stay at North Dormer if they could help it? You wouldn't, folks say. With lowered head he asked, where'd you go to? Anywhere where I can earn my living. I'll try here first, and if I can't do it here I'll go somewhere else. I'll go up the mountain if I have to. She paused on this threat, and saw that it had taken effect. I want you should get Miss Hatchard and the selectmen to take me at the library, and I want a woman here in the house with me, she repeated. Mr. Royal had grown exceedingly pale. When she ended he stood up ponderously, leaning against the desk, and for a second or two they looked at each other. See here, he said at length as though utterance were difficult, there's something I've been wanting to say to you, I'd ought to have said it before. I want you to marry me. The girl still stared at him without moving. I want you to marry me, he repeated, clearing his throat. The minister'll be up here next Sunday and we can fix it up then. Or I'll drive you down to Hepburn to the justice, and get it done there. I'll do whatever you say. His eyes fell into the merciless stare she continued to fix on him, and he shifted his weight uneasily from one foot to the other. As he stood there before her, unwieldy, shabby, disordered, the purple veins distorting the hands he pressed against the desk, and his long orator's jaw trembling with the effort of his avowal, he seemed like a hideous parody of the fatherly old man she had always known. Marry you? Me? She burst out with a scornful laugh. Was that what you came to ask me the other night? What's come over you, I wonder? How long is it since you've looked at yourself in the glass? She straightened herself, insolently conscious of her youth and strength. I suppose you think it would be cheaper to marry me than to keep a hired girl. Everybody knows you're the closest man in Eagle County, but I guess you're not going to get your mending done for you that way twice. Mr. Royal did not move while she spoke. His face was ash-colored and his black eyebrows quivered as though the blaze of her scorn had blinded him. When she ceased he held up his hand. That'll do, that'll about do, he said. He turned to the door and took his hat from the hat peg. On the threshold he paused. People ain't been fair to me from the first, they ain't been fair to me, he said. Then he went out. A few days later North Dormer learned with surprise that Charity had been appointed librarian of the Hatchard Memorial at a salary of $8 a month, and that old Verena Marsh, from the Creston Almshouse, was coming to live at Lawyer Royal's and do the cooking. 3. It was not in the room known at the Red House as Mr. Royal's office that he received his infrequent clients. Professional dignity and masculine independence made it necessary that he should have a real office, under a different roof, and his standing as the only lawyer of North Dormer required that the roof should be the same as that which sheltered the town hall and the post office. It was his habit to walk to this office twice a day, morning and afternoon. It was on the ground floor of the building, with a separate entrance, and a weathered nameplate on the door. Before going in, he stepped into the post office for his mail. Usually an empty ceremony, said a word or two to the town clerk, who sat across the passage in idle state, and then went over to the store on the opposite corner, where Carrick Fry, the storekeeper, always kept a chair for him, and where he was sure to find one or two selectmen leaning on the long counter, in an atmosphere of rope, leather, tar and coffee beans. Mr. Royle, though monosyllabic at home, was not averse, in certain moods, to imparting his views to his fellow townsmen. Perhaps, also, he was unwilling that his rare clients should surprise him sitting, clerkless and unoccupied, in his dusty office. At any rate, his hours there were not much longer or more regular than Charity's at the library. The rest of the time he spent either at the store or in driving about the country on business connected with the insurance companies that he represented, or in sitting at home reading Bancroft's History of the United States and the speeches of Daniel Webster. Since the day when Charity had told him that she wished to succeed to Eudora Skeff's post, their relations had undefinably but definitely changed. Lawyer Royle had kept his word. He had obtained the place for her at the cost of considerable maneuvering, as she guessed from the number of rival candidates, and from the acerbity with which two of them, Orma Fry and the eldest Dargat girl, treated her for nearly a year afterward. And he had engaged Verena Marsh to come up from Creston and do the cooking. Verena was a poor old widow, doddering and shiftless. Charity suspected that she came for her keep. Mr. Royle was too close a man to give a dollar a day to a smart girl when he could get a deaf pauper for nothing. But at any rate, Verena was there, in the attic just over Charity, and the fact that she was deaf did not greatly trouble the young girl. Charity knew that what had happened on that hateful night would not happen again. She understood that, profoundly as she had despised Mr. Royle ever since, he despised himself still more profoundly. If she had asked for a woman in the house, it was far less for her own defense than for his humiliation. She needed no one to defend her, his humbled pride was her surest protection. He had never spoken a word of excuse or extenuation, the incident was as if it had never been. Yet its consequences were latent in every word that he and she exchanged, in every glance they instinctively turned from each other. Nothing now would ever shake her rule in the Red House. On the night of her meeting with Miss Hatchard's cousin, Charity lay in bed, her bare arms clasped under her rough head, and continued to think of him. She supposed that he meant to spend some time in North Dormer. He had said he was looking up the old houses in the neighborhood, and though she was not very clear as to his purpose, or as to why anyone should look for old houses, when they lay in wait for one on every roadside, she understood that he needed the help of books, and resolved to hunt up the next day the volume she had failed to find, and any others that seemed related to the subject. Never had her ignorance of life and literature so weighed on her as in reliving the short scene of her discomfiture. "It's no use trying to be anything in this place," she muttered to her pillow, and she shriveled at the vision of big metropolises, shining super Nettletons, where girls in better clothes than Belle Balk's talked fluently of architecture to young men with hands like Lucius Harney's. Then she remembered his sudden pause when he had come close to the desk and had his first look at her. The sight had made him forget what he was going to say. She recalled the change in his face, and jumping up she ran over the bare boards to her washstand, found the matches, lit a candle, and lifted it to the square of looking glass on the whitewashed wall. Her small face, usually so darkly pale, glowed like a rose in the faint orb of light, and under her rumpled hair her eyes seemed deeper and larger than by day. Perhaps after all it was a mistake to wish they were blue. A clumsy band and button fastened her unbleached nightgown about the throat. She undid it, freed her thin shoulders, and saw herself a bride in low-necked satin, walking down an aisle with Lucius Harney. He would kiss her as they left the church. She put down the candle and covered her face with her hands as if to imprison the kiss. At that moment she heard Mr. Royle's step as he came up the stairs to bed, and a fierce revulsion of feeling swept over her. Until then she had merely despised him, now deep hatred of him filled her heart. He became to her a horrible old man. The next day, when Mr. Royle came back to dinner, they faced each other in silence as usual. Verena's presence at the table was an excuse for their not talking, though her deafness would have permitted the freest interchange of confidences. But when the meal was over, and Mr. Royle rose from the table, he looked back at Charity, who had stayed to help the old woman clear away the dishes. "I want to speak to you a minute," he said, and she followed him across the passage, wondering. He seated himself in his black horsehair armchair, and she leaned against the window, indifferently. She was impatient to be gone to the library, to hunt for the book on North Dormer. "See here," he said, "why ain't you at the library the days you're supposed to be there?" The question, breaking in on her mood of blissful abstraction, deprived her of speech,
and she stared at him for a moment without answering.
Who says I ain't? There's been some complaints made, it appears. Miss Hatchard sent for me this morning.
Charity's smoldering resentment broke into a blaze. I know. Orma Fry, and that toad of a Targat girl and Ben Fry, like as not. He's going round with her. The low-down sneaks, I always knew they'd try to have me out. As if anybody ever came to the library, anyhow.
Somebody did yesterday, and you weren't there.
Yesterday? She laughed at her happy recollection. At what time wasn't I there yesterday, I'd like to know?
Round about 4 o'clock.
Charity was silent. She had been so steeped in the dreamy remembrance of young Harney's visit that she had forgotten having deserted her post as soon as he had left the library.
Who came at 4 o'clock?
Miss Hatcher did.
Miss Hatchard?
Why, she ain't ever been near the place since she's been lame. She couldn't get up the steps if she tried.
She can be helped up, I guess.
She was yesterday, anyhow, by the young fellow that's staying with her. He found you there, I understand, earlier in the afternoon, and he went back and told Miss Hatchard the books were in bad shape and needed attending to. She got excited, and had herself wheeled straight round, and when she got there the place was locked. So she sent for me, and told me about that, and about the other complaints. She claims you've neglected things, and that she's going to get a trained librarian.
Charity had not moved while he spoke. She stood with her head thrown back against the window frame, her arms hanging against her sides, and her hands so tightly clenched that she felt, without knowing what hurt her, the sharp edge of her nails against her palms. Of all Mr. Royal had said, she had retained only the phrase, "He told Miss Hatchard the books were in bad shape." What did she care for the other charges against her? Malice or truth, she despised them as she despised her detractors. But that the stranger to whom she had felt herself so mysteriously drawn should have betrayed her. That at the very moment when she had fled up the hillside to think of him more deliciously, he should have been hastening home to denounce her shortcomings. She remembered how, in the darkness of her room, she had covered her face to press his imagined kiss closer, and her heart raged against him for the liberty he had not taken.
Well, I'll go, she said suddenly. I'll go right off.
Go where? She heard the startled note in Mr. Royal's voice.
Why, out of their old library, straight out, and never set foot in it again. They needn't think I'm going to wait round and let them say they've discharged me.
Charity, Charity Royal, you listen, he began, getting heavily out of his chair, but she waved him aside, and walked out of the room. Upstairs she took the library key from the place where she always hid it under her pincushion, who said she wasn't careful, put on her hat, and swept down again and out into the street. If Mr. Royal heard her go, he made no motion to detain her. His sudden rages probably made him understand the uselessness of reasoning with hers. She reached the brick temple, unlocked the door and entered into the glacial twilight. I'm glad I'll never have to sit in this old vault again when other folks are out in the sun, she said aloud as the familiar chill took her. She looked with abhorrence at the long dingy rows of books, the sheep-nosed Minerva on her black pedestal, and the mild-faced young man in a high stock whose effigy pined above her desk. She meant to take out of the drawer her roll of lace and the library register, and go straight to Miss Hatchard to announce her resignation. But suddenly a great desolation overcame her, and she sat down and laid her face against the desk. Her heart was ravaged by life's cruelest discovery. The first creature who had come toward her out of the wilderness had brought her anguish instead of joy. She did not cry, tears came hard to her, and the storms of her heart spent themselves inwardly. But as she sat there in her dumb woe, she felt her life to be too desolate, too ugly and intolerable. What have I ever done to it, that it should hurt me so? She groaned, and pressed her fists against her lids, which were beginning to swell with weeping. I won't go there looking like a horror, she muttered, springing up and pushing back her hair as if it stifled her. She opened the drawer, dragged out the register, and turned toward the door. As she did so, it opened, and the young man from Miss Hatchard's came in whistling, "Four." He stopped and lifted his hat with a shy smile. "I beg your pardon," he said. "I thought there was no one here." Charity stood before him, barring his way. "You can't come in. The library ain't open to the public Wednesdays."
"I know it's not, but my cousin gave me her key."
"Miss Hatchard's got no right to give her key to other folks, any more than I have. I'm the librarian and I know the bylaws. This is my library." The young man looked profoundly surprised.
"Why, I know it is. I'm so sorry if you mind my coming. I suppose you came to see what more you could say to set her against me? But you needn't trouble, it's my library today, but it won't be this time tomorrow. I'm on the way now to take her back the key and the register. Young Harney's face grew grave, but without betraying the consciousness of guilt she had looked for.
I don't understand, he said. There must be some mistake. Why should I say things against you to Miss Hatchard or to anyone?
The apparent evasiveness of the reply caused Charity's indignation to overflow.
I don't know why you should. I could understand Orma Fry's doing it, because she's always wanted to get me out of here ever since the first day. I can't see why, when she's got her own home, and her father to work for her, nor Ida Target, neither, when she got a legacy from her stepbrother only last year. But anyway, we all live in the same place, and when it's a place like North Dormer, it's enough to make people hate each other just to have to walk down the same street every day. But you don't live here, and you don't know anything about any of us, so what did you have to meddle for? Do you suppose the other girls have kept the books any better than I did? Why, Orma Fry don't hardly know a book from a flat iron. And what if I don't always sit round here doing nothing till it strikes 5 up at the church? Who cares if the library's open or shut? Do you suppose anybody ever comes here for books? What they'd like to come for is to meet the fellows they're going with if I'd let them. But I wouldn't let Bill Salas from over the hill hang round here waiting for the youngest Target girl, because I know him. That's all. Even if I don't know about books all I ought to. She stopped with a choking in her throat. Tremors of rage were running through her, and she steadied herself against the edge of the desk lest he should see her weakness. What he saw seemed to affect him deeply, for he grew red under his sunburn, and stammered out, "But Mississippi Royal, I assure you. I assure you." His distress inflamed her anger, and she regained her voice to fling back, "If I was you, I'd have the nerve to stick to what I said." The taunt seemed to restore his presence of mind. "I hope I should if I knew, but I don't. Apparently something disagreeable has happened, for which you think I'm to blame. But I don't know what it is, because I've been up on Eagle Ridge ever since the early morning. I don't know where you've been this morning, but I know you were here in this library yesterday, and it was you that went home and told your cousin the books were in bad shape, and brought her round to see how I'd neglected them." Young Harney looked sincerely concerned. "Was that what you were told? I don't wonder you're angry. The books are in bad shape, and as some are interesting, it's a pity. I told Miss Hatchard they were suffering from dampness and lack of air, and I brought her here to show her how easily the place could be ventilated."